Welcome to another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, originating in San Francisco. As you may know, our program is supported by listeners, and I thank you for your support. The information's on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. And for this program, I'd like to thank James Bonaventure of Baldwin, Missouri. Appreciate your support and glad to know you're listening. This is the eighth installment in the Boiling Frogs series. Powerful interviews co-hosted by Sibel Edmonds. And what you're about to hear is another whistleblower, this time from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. John Cole worked there for 18 years. And in part, he corroborates the credibility and some of the allegations that you've heard recently from Sibel Edmonds about corruption in Washington, foreign governments and foreign agents with undue influence. John Cole worked on counterintelligence, and he has a lot to say. And he has his own story, a whistleblower story of how he left the FBI, and it wasn't the way he wanted to. He reported wrongdoing and inefficiencies, expecting that his bosses would do something about it. And what they did was threaten to withdraw John Cole's security clearance so he wouldn't be able to do his job. Here comes the story now on the Peter B. Collins Show. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is John M. Cole, who worked for 18-plus years in the FBI's counterintelligence division. One of his tasks was to conduct risk assessment for FBI foreign-born translators and analyst applicants. Back in 1999, he discovered and began reporting serious issues of mismanagement, gross negligence, security breaches, cover-ups, and intentional blocking of intelligence that had national security implications. He wrote these issues in several letters to FBI management, including the director, Robert Mueller, to no avail. And after he reported these acts to FBI management, they retaliated, and ultimately he left the FBI in March of 2004. He currently works as a senior counterintelligence analyst for the United States Air Force. John Cole, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us, and I want to mention as well that you have a book that will be due out shortly around the 1st of October. It's called While America Sleeps, An FBI Whistleblower's Story. Congratulations, and I hope that your book gets a wide reception, and a lot of people will start to understand some of the issues that you're raising. In a broad sense, what are the central points of your book that people need to know about, and why do you think that America is sleeping?
Well, I wrote the book because I think there needs to be accountability and oversight. There's a lack of oversight and accountability within a lot of government agencies, especially the FBI. And what's happening is the government is starting to take away our rights, and they're using that to gain information. It's going back, like back in the 60s and 70s with COINTELPRO.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing our rights. They're targeting innocent Americans. And no one seems to care. No one seems to be doing anything about that. And what's going to happen is we're going to wind up, you know, into, as a Gestapo state, a police state. And I just I can't see that happening. I mean, I've been in, you know, I'm an American. When I was in the FBI, I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and to protect people's rights. And that's just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very upsetting.
And if you were to try to identify the source of the problem, is it congressional committees that fail in their oversight function, either intentionally or unintentionally? Is it a failure of the media to fully investigate issues and expose wrongdoing? Is it a systemic corruption that goes beyond what I just described?
Well, it's a bit of everything that you just described. First of all, the biggest problem is, and I want to make this clear, a lot of people, there's a lot of good people in the FBI. I still have a lot of friends that work in the FBI. The worker bees, I mean, if it wasn't for them, the FBI would have a complete meltdown. It's the management in the FBI that has the problem. They seem to be above the law. They think they can get away with everything they, you know, what they're getting away with right now, and they can cover it up without any problems. There's no accountability. They, if they do get caught, you know, they're allowed to retire. They're not fired. They're not put in prison. They're not, you know, they're allowed to retire, draw a pension, and their life goes on, which I think is a big mistake. I mean, when I was in the FBI, I saw these problems. I reported them to Director Mueller. In fact, I hand carried the letters right to his office. Never received a response from him. I then went ahead and sent it over to the Attorney General, which I never received a response from the Attorney General. Then I wound up going up to the Hill, to the Senate, and testifying to the Senate Judiciary Committee on what some of these issues were. Mismanagement, waste of government funds, or taxpayer funds, espionage within the FBI. It just goes on and on and on. You know, violation of people's rights.
Mm-hmm.
With the Patriot Act, I list a lot of those in my book. In fact, when the Patriot Act was approved, there's a lot of agents in the FBI that didn't really know what that covered. They just assumed they could do certain things, and some of the things they were doing were actually illegal.
Now, John, most people are familiar with the legal concept of a mandated reporter, and they know this in the case of child abuse, mm-hmm. where if a teacher or a doctor sees evidence, they have no choice but to report that to the proper authorities. It's part of the law, and they can be penalized if they fail to do so. Likewise, when you're hired as an agent at the FBI, as I understand it, you sign agreements that say if you discover or are a witness to wrongdoing, that you are a mandated reporter. You have no choice. You must come forward and tell your superiors through channels and in appropriate secure communications what you have witnessed and why you think it deserves investigation. Do I have that right?
That is correct. Not only do you do that when you're hired, but every year, the Attorney General sends a communication over to every employee in the FBI or in the Department of Justice that states the same thing, that we are to report any mismanagement, abuse of power, violations of law, espionage, security violations, et cetera. And we have to sign that saying that we understood that document.
And so you took this literally. And over 18 years, you were conditioned to believe that if you came forward with this kind of information, that you would not become a victim or a subject of retaliation, but that you would be respected and that appropriate steps would be taken. Is that your, that was your expectation?
Exactly. Exactly. When I first went into the FBI, I was happy as can be. I was thinking I got hired by the premier law enforcement agency of the world. I was thinking we're going to fight for justice, people's rights, and I was proud to be part of that organization. when I first went into the FBI, of course, I was very naive And my first supervisor, by the way, was Bob Hansen.
Yeah, he's behind bars now.
Yes, for espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this belief, though, that still I'm working for the best agency in the world, and we're here to protect people's rights and make sure that there's justice. It wasn't until later in my career, and I have to clarify that, when I first went into the FBI, too, I didn't see a lot of the major problems that I saw later on. I think I started really seeing a lot of problems in the FBI, probably in the 1993, starting in 1993, and it just got worse after that. And that's when, if you recall, that's when they had the Oklahoma City bombing, they had the first World Trade Center bombing, they had the Ruby Ridge incident,
mm-hmm.
Waco.
Yeah, Waco,
that,
too.
Uh-huh. That area, in that time frame.
Right.
And I could see there's a lot of problems. And, but, you know, in my heart, I still felt that the FBI was the ultimate place to be. You know, we're going to get this right, and we're going to correct these mistakes. That wasn't the case. It just got worse. And I felt obligated to report. I worked undercover for 2 years, and I saw the mismanagement in this undercover operation that I was working. And one guy that was working with us, it got so bad that he tried to commit suicide, and he wound up in counseling. They sent a replacement up, and the first day that gentleman was there, he looked at me and says, "John, how can you do this? I mean, this is unbelievable." And I told him, I said, his name was Steve, I said, "Steve, if it gets too bad, go home. You know, we'll take care of it." Well, 5 weeks later, he wound up with a nervous breakdown. And then I said, "You know, I can't do this anymore. Something has to change. You know, I've sent letters to headquarters in regards to this mismanagement issues and the security issues, and no one's doing anything about it." So I put a request in to go back to headquarters. When I got back to headquarters, I went and spoke with the deputy assistant director, and I was assured that he was going to look into these problems and they were going to be taken care of. Well, they weren't. In fact, what happened is the person that was responsible for most of these issues, and the manager that was responsible at the time, they promoted him. So I thought, well, this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of kept my to myself for a while. I was getting exceptional ratings at the FBI all those years, and this is 2000 that I went back to headquarters, and my performance appraisal went from exceptional down to minimally acceptable. And then I contested it, and I took it up, and I said, "This ain't right, you know, because this is what I've done. In fact, I've done more than I did the prior year, and I got exceptional ratings that year, so why am I getting rated so low?" The individual in the Administrative Services Division of the FBI told me that, "Oh, we'll take care of this." It went to the section chief up there, who just sat on it, didn't do anything with it. I had to write the Senate in order for them to start inquiring about it before it was finally changed. It was about a year later.
Yeah, John, let's talk about the Senate, because you and I ended up going to the same people.
Yeah.
Even before we knew each other.
Uh-huh.
Actually, our meeting is very, very interesting. Peter, when my case became public for the first time, it was through this article ran by Washington Post, and they reported on the espionage case, Reed Dickerson.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the witnesses they had who talked about the espionage problem within the FBI was John Cole. And he was quoted there, and he was in charge of the counterintelligence operations. So as soon as I read his name, I was like, I really need to know this person. So for a couple of years, we were trying to find each other, and we finally did through my organization. But, John, you went to Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy. Leahy, Democrat, Senator Grassley, Republican. They were in charge of the Judiciary Committee.
That's correct.
And we ended up with similar experiences. You know, initially, very welcoming attitude. Yes, we want to know about everything. Bring in your complaints and follow-ups. And then once they got everything, suddenly, you know, at some point they just went, Mom. I want to also mention something else that I just found out, and we'll maybe talk about that later. I was going through this Foreign Agents Registration Act for the Turkish lobby, and I started seeing all these trips to Turkey arranged for Senator Leahy, and he's not even on the appropriate committee, like he's not on the Foreign Relations Committee, that started in 2004, and this is around the time that he went really silent about my case. So that's one thing I'm looking into. But tell us about your experience with the Senate offices.
Well, that was that was interesting, Sibel, because when I started reporting stuff to the Senate, I sent them a letter after I didn't receive any response from Director Mueller, and after I didn't receive any response from the Attorney General, Ashcroft. I sent a letter to Senator Grassley, Leahy, and Arlen Specter, and I got a call one night at home. It was 8 o'clock at night. It was one of Senator Grassley's investigators called me up and said that Senator Grassley wanted to see me the next day. And I told him, I said, well, I'm going to have to go into the FBI and notify management that you're requesting my presence at the Hill. And he told me, no, you can't do that. He goes, I have a letter from Senator Grassley, which I still have, stating that I'm to report to the Senate Judiciary Committee to talk about oversight issues, and I'm not to tell anybody in the FBI. So I wound up going up there the next day at I think it was at 2 o'clock, and actually I took leave to do that because I didn't want anybody in the bureau to know I was going up there. And I spent 2.5 to 3 hours up there talking to, basically the investigators and Senator Grassley, Specter, and Leahy. And they were really interested in finding out what was going on. Of course, I reported the case about the language specialist and the possible espionage. And they were interested in that. They were also interested in the Trilogy. If you remember, the Trilogy program was the computer system the Bureau was trying to implement enhance their capabilities as far as searches and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them back then, this was back in 2002. I said, we call it at the Bureau tragedy because everybody knows it's not going to work. And they're spending all this money on this system, and it's never going to come into play. It'll never work. And they were at the stands. This is great. And I said, well, and there's a problem with espionage. We had Bob Hansen arrested for espionage, and the Bureau came out and said they're going to make all these changes so that this will never happen again. And then, here's 9/11 occurs. Right after 9/11, the Bureau's in this frenzy on hiring all these language specialists. They said, that's the biggest problem. We don't have enough language specialists, so we need to hire them. So there was this big push to hire these language specialists.
Like Sibel Edmonds?
Like Sibel Edmonds. except for Sibel Edmonds is a patriot, and I don't have any doubt that she is a true American. There was a language specialist. I got the applicant's file on my desk, and I was working the Pint Bomb investigation. This was right after 9/11. So I was working the Pint Bomb investigation from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. in the morning, and I was going back to my desk where I handled India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And there was a young lady that was applying for a translator position, and they wanted me to do a risk assessment on her. Well, when I went through the file that day, I noticed that there was something not right. I couldn't picture, and I was just too tired because I just got off working 12 hours at night. So I decided to go home, get some rest, and come back and come back in early and then take a look at it. When I went through it, I realized that she had marked down that her father was a retired general, Pakistani general, and that he lived in Pakistan for 6 months out of the year. When I did a name search on him, using the old ACS system of the FBI, which I still believe they use that today, because they still don't have a viable system up and running. So his name came up, and it showed that he used to be a military attaché for Pakistan in Washington, D.C., and he was an intelligence officer. So I wrote the report up saying that, you know, she shouldn't be hired, this translator shouldn't be hired, and sent down security programs, and the young lady down there told me, she goes, well, I'm glad you saw this, because I knew something wasn't right. And I told her, well, have the counterterrorism people look at it, too, just to make sure that, you know, have them put their two cents in, into this, too. A week later, I got a phone call from the security specialist, and she said, Mr. Cole, she goes, can you tell me who I need to send this package up to in counterterrorism? So I gave the gave her the guy's name, and she goes, not that it matters. I go, what do you mean? I said, she goes, well, the FBI hired her, and they gave her a top-secret SCI clearance, and she's working at Washington Field Office. I just couldn't believe it. So I wrote another letter to the Senate.
Before you go any further, first... her name became public because as you know, Paul Sperry wrote this book called Infiltration, and her name is Hadiyah Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And Hadiyah Roberts actually worked in this translation station that was only two desks to my right while I was working for the FBI's Washington field office. There's another interesting angle with this Hadiyah story before we move to the Senate's response, or actually their lack of response to this very, very major issue, major case. As you said, John, her father worked for the ISI, the military attaché in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Who he worked under was very interesting, too. He worked Hadiyah Roberts, the FBI language specialist, the TSC. Her father's boss was General Mahmoud. You're familiar, of course, with General Mahmoud, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Of ISI. And he was meeting with Mark Grossman either the day before 9/11 or in the day of that it happened, September 11 terrorist attack. Now, her father worked for General Mahmoud, and if you, this is for our listeners, check General Mahmoud's name and search it, you will get a lot of info on his connection to 9/11. And she didn't even hide this fact. And here she was actually listening to Pakistani's military attaché in D.C. And these are her father's friend and her father's boss, you know. And how did this happen? I mean, how could they? I mean, can just incompetence explain this, John?
Well, I can't figure this out. To this day, I still can't figure it out why they hired her. But I understand that they also hired her son, and he works there as a contractor.
Absolutely. I was there when they hired her son. And do you know where she's working right now?
No, I
haven't. She was promoted. She is in the FBI's headquarters in charge of the entire Pakistani translation division. She is in the supervisory position.
That's just amazing.
That's right.
That's just amazing. See, what was interesting about after she was hired, about 2 months after that, we had a. I received a communication from Washington Field Office, and if they don't know the name of the person, they, you know how that works with Civil, they put it as an unknown subject.
Correct.
Case.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an unknown subject case they opened up because somebody had supplied the Pakistani government with some information. I won't go into the details of the information, but when I started looking into that. Communication that came to headquarters, since I ran the Pakistani program, the counterintelligence program, there's only a handful of people that would have had access to that information, her being one of them.
Right.
But that case was opened up just for a very short period of time, and then it was closed. Somebody closed the case. It was the same with... after I started making all these inquiries into, you know, what the hell's going on type thing, and something that needs to be changed, and I started writing letters to Director Mueller again, of course, the FBI management came after me and said that they have a problem with my security clearance. And I asked them, I said, what's the problem? I said, I just got 6 months prior, I just got a communication from security program saying my 5-year reinvestigation had been completed, and I'm good for another 5 years. So what could have possibly come up in that period of time. And they wouldn't tell me. They just said, we're looking at you because we have a problem with your security background.
Right.
Now, at some point, John, were you tempted to go to Radio Shack and buy a Geiger counter to see if you actually were radioactive?
I probably should have done that.
But more seriously, what this suggests is deep infiltration and penetration of foreign interests into high levels of our security management, including where you worked at the FBI. And this is deeply troubling. This goes beyond embarrassments or things that are inconvenient. That is a thread that, to my knowledge, was never followed up on by the 9/11 Commission.
Never.
Nor has it been followed up on by the American media.
Well, don't get me started with the 9/11 Commission, because I don't have much faith in the 9/11 Commission.
Oh, please, John, let's talk about it, because this is a good point to talk about that, because it's very relevant, and please go ahead.
Well, the thing with the 9/11 Commission, everybody, there's a lot of people that I know, including myself, that put our two cents into, you know, what we felt was wrong and what needed to be changed, and some of the issues that we saw. And not one of those issues was placed into the 9/11 Commission report. It was almost as if they ignored everything that most of us, if not all of us, told them.
9/11 Omission Report.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the thing is that there's a lot of information that's out there that prior to 9/11, there was agents that could have prevented 9/11 if they were allowed to go ahead with some of the operations that they were working. But they were getting held back by FBI headquarters.
Now, are you speaking of Colleen Rowley or others?
I'm talking of others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a Phoenix memo. There's Colleen Rowley. Mm-hmm. There's Wright in Chicago. There's a number of them. Also, the FBI had a paid informant that lived with one of the hijackers in California.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just goes on and on and on. There's so much out there that there's no reason why that 9/11 could not have been prevented. If they would have been doing what they were supposed to be doing, if people at headquarters, at FBI management at headquarters, looked at what they were supposed to be looking at and did what they were supposed to be, you know, what they should have been doing, we would not have had 9/11 occur. I truly feel that in my heart, that should never have occurred, and we should have been able to prevent that.
John, I share your criticism of the 9/11 Commission, and I went to Washington, spent quite some time there personally watching the undertakings, and I came away with no confidence. Now, you were assigned to the team that investigated the Pentagon attack, and I'd just like to ask you, because I'm one of these 9/11 truthers. Now, I do not argue that it was an inside job. I don't have any information to sustain that. But I don't believe the official story, and I don't believe, I don't have confidence in the work of the Kane-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission. But tell me, do you have any misgivings about what has been reported that occurred at the Pentagon? And in particular, was the hole in the side of the building big enough to swallow up an airliner? And did that airliner simply disintegrate inside the building, leaving nary a trace of physical evidence?
Well, I, to be honest with you, when I talk about the Pent Bomb investigation, that's the investigation the Bureau named for the entire attacks of 9/11.
Okay.
So as far as, you know, simply the investigation on the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
I have no idea. I mean, what I was doing on the Pent Bomb investigation is right after 9/11, I mean, the day after, I was up in the command center, they call it the SIOG in the FBI, and I was taking in phone calls, trying to find any leads that were coming out, and we were also trying to make sure that there was no other attacks that were going to occur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wanted to make sure that we could prevent something else that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the actual investigating the attacks on the Pentagon, I really don't know.
Okay.
To be honest.
Well, then let me ask a broader question, because here you're a man who took seriously the commitments that you had made to report wrongdoing. You did so, and you were retaliated against.
Yes.
Those who were actually responsible for the failures, in most cases, were permitted to keep their jobs, and in some cases, were actually promoted.
That's correct.
How does that feel to you, and what is your speculation about the way that this has happened? Because, you know, I compare it to the Super Bowl. We got skunked on 9/11.
Yep.
And a team that loses the Super Bowl gets a new coach, a new defensive coordinator, a new offensive coordinator, maybe even a whole new offensive team. But we kept the same people in place. Very few protocols or procedures, including the FAA and NORAD. We created this new intelligence czar, but there's no indication that the FBI is communicating better with the CIA and the NSA than it did before 9/11. Seeing failure rewarded, what signal does that send you?
Well, it sends the wrong message out. It's, you know, like when I went and reported and Sib Albert reported what she saw, we got retaliated against. I mean, they wanted us out. And they were going to do everything they could. I mean, they threatened my family. I mean, there's just so much. And the stress was unbearable. But you wanted to keep going because you knew that, or you were hoping anyway, that, you know, somebody was going to do us right. Instead, you find that these people that were responsible were not only getting promoted, some of them were able to retire and come back as contractors and make more money. It's just amazing. It's like it's this mentality, this culture that, you know, we're going to take care of each other, and you don't tell, you know, don't tell on me and I won't tell on you. It sends a bad message out because people are afraid to report anything that goes on as wrong. So they allow it. They allow it to happen. They say, "Well, I'm going to turn my head, take a blind eye to that because I want to be able to retire." And that's unfortunate. And
John,
they don't want to go through the retaliation.
It's true, and I agree with you. How about the cases that are not even explained by this particular justification? And let's talk about one of the you were quoted by Jeff Stein on this issue of Israeli lobby and the espionage by Israel, mm-hmm. and how the State Department and the lobby pressure basically is able to make these investigations and some really high-level criminal espionage and criminal conduct and investigation operations just evaporate and go away. Can you tell us about that?
That's not just the Israeli they have a huge lobby, and they have a lot of influence in government, in our government. And if they put enough pressure on, you know, the United States, we want to make sure, or I should say people within the government, want to make sure that we don't rock the boat. We don't want to send a bad message out to the Israelis that, you know, we're not going to support them or whatever, that they're our allies. We need them, especially right now with this war on terror, which I hate to use that term. But
thank you.
But and don't get me started on that because I was so far against the war with Iraq.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of reasons for that, and I list those in my book. but anyway, there are several things. I mean, I can go back and I think Sybil and I talked about this before. There was when I started causing all these problems with the Southeast Asia desk that I worked, that I ran at headquarters, and I was bringing all these issues up about the espionage and the problems within the FBI, they decided to go ahead and transfer me and put me in and had me handle the Sub-Saharan African desk, thinking that, you know, there was nothing going on in Sub-Saharan Africa. John can't cause any problems. We'll just leave him there and just keep him quiet. Well, the only problem with that is they had the issue with Niger, you know, with the whole The Iraqi government was trying to obtain plutonium from Niger, or uranium from Niger.
Yellow cake, uh-huh.
And then there was also the case with the anthrax investigation, Hatfield. And then the other thing that came to my desk was an espionage case on a language specialist at Washington Field Office. Well, the thing is that when I read through that espionage investigation, first of all, the first thing that struck me was a preliminary inquiry, which I thought, why is this a preliminary inquiry when This is an espionage investigation against a former, this guy had left the FBI, a former FBI language specialist. So I made it a full investigation. I started reading through the file, and I said, boy, this guy should be arrested. We have enough in the file to to arrest him and for a conviction. And I asked to take the file up to the U.S. attorney to see if there was enough for him to prosecute, which I'm sure there would have been enough evidence in there to go ahead and make the arrest. And I was told not to. The only thing I could think of is the politics involved. The FBI did not want to have any bad press come out about, oh, we have another spy in the FBI. And it's like this with a lot of these other things. We want to make sure that we have this relationship with Israel. They have a huge lobby in D.C. They give a lot of money to politicians. The politicians don't want to hear it. They don't want to do anything negative against the Israelis. They don't want to have any bad press about the Israelis. You know, the Israelis are spying on us. They're stealing our technology. They're doing all these nasty things to us in our own country. That's not going to look good if we want to have a good relationship with Israel. So everything is quieted down. You know, they just as soon say, well, no, we don't have any problem. You know, everything's fine.
And John, if I may, this article from Congressional Quarterly, which quoted you, really surprised me, because I'm aware of the Jonathan Pollard case.
Yes.
Most people are. This goes back quite a ways, and he's considered a hero in Israel, and they repeatedly pressed the U.S. government to commute his sentence and release him.
Right.
But it's clear that he was not only spying for Israel, but he was selling his information to other countries, including Pakistan.
That's correct.
But they quote you as saying that in a two-year period alone,
yes,
from 1993 to 1995, that you were managing at least 125 open cases of Israeli espionage. Now, this is astounding to me, because it suggests that this is quite pervasive, and if we just take that snapshot and apply it to the last 20 or 30 years, then this is a very significant effort by one of our allies,
mm-hmm,
to steal our information, presumably exclusively for their own use, but we have no way of controlling it once they get a hold of it. So give us a sense of how widespread this is and how much we should be concerned about an alleged ally that has such a detailed espionage operation in the United States.
I think it should be of great concern. We give the Israeli government a ton of money and support, and we also give them a lot of our military equipment and some of the new technologies we have to help them out. What they try to get from us, the Israelis, what we don't give them, they try to get from us, basically. And what winds up happening is we're finding out, you know, they wind up using the technology they steal, basically, to enhance their capabilities. But they also use it and transform it into their own systems, which they wind up selling to countries that the United States does not want those countries to have that technology,
mm-hmm,
for various reasons, which is problematic. And no one seems to want to do anything about it here. I mean, when I ran that program, it was so obvious. I mean, they were so blatant about what they were doing. There was an espionage case I had involving an Israeli and an Air Force civilian. This is years ago. And it was funny because it was a solid case where we had evidence showing that this individual was taking and providing the Israeli intelligence officer with classified material. But for some reason, when I started looking into the case, we found out that we couldn't use any of the evidence because someone had destroyed the evidence. So when I got down to the area where this was occurring, and I went to the local the FBI office down in that area, and then it was a joint Air Force OSI investigation too. The OSI headquarters guy from D.C. went down there with me, and we were shocked. The evidence that they gathered, they had no chain of custody on. They just threw it in a closet. It was almost as if they wanted it just to fail. They didn't want it to go further. They didn't want it to get to a point where it was going to become public, that there was going to be arrests made, because it was going to cause bad press.
And, John, did you ever see the outlines of a policy or some explicit agreements with Israel that if we find one of your people spying on our country, this is how we'll handle it?
Well, I never really seen anything in writing in regards to that. What I was going by was the Attorney General guidelines on espionage. If you're committing espionage, if you're doing what you're not supposed to be doing here, and that goes with anybody, any intelligence organization, an intelligence officer coming into the United States is supposed to declare himself by our laws. He's supposed to declare himself as an intelligence officer, and he or she, whoever it is supposed to tell us exactly what they're planning on doing in the U.S., and we have to agree to it or not agree to it. And that's not, of course, spying against us. But the thing is that if we catch them spying on us, then we normally, if it's a I.O., we normally wind up sending a letter into the State Department, and then normally they're PNG'd out of the country. That's how that normally works.
And that stands for persona non grata?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we kick them out of the country, and they can't come back. That's how that normally works. And nothing is pretty much kept quiet. No one really knows what's going on. You know, the American public doesn't know that, you know, like two Israelis got PNG out of the country, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make that public normally. And everything's kind of quieted down. The only time it becomes public is when there's a U.S. person involved in an espionage case, and that person is arrested. Then normally it becomes public, and then the public says, oh, my God, this guy was spying for Israel or spying for, you know, whoever, Russia or whatever, whoever it might be. And there's a lot of hype about, you know, oh, we need better security. We need this. We need that. And, of course, then they come out and say, we're going to take care of that. We've made, adjustments so that we can catch these guys and we can do this, and this ain't going to happen again. But it continues to go on.
Mm-hmm.
What's sad about it is, it's not the IOs, the intelligence officers that we know that are out there, because we know who they are. I mean, the U.S. government knows who the intelligence officers are that come into the United States. I mean, we have a very good idea of everyone that comes in here, if they're an intelligence officer or a unknown or suspected intelligence officer. What we don't know is the insiders, the people that work inside the government, that are working for these governments also. And that's my biggest fear.
Mm-hmm. Now, John, one of the issues that surfaced with James Bamford, he's the expert on the NSA, who was our guest on the very first Boiling Frogs interview in this series, he revealed that two key pieces of equipment that are used in the massive interception of our domestic communications were made by companies that are Israeli-based, Naris and Verint. Mm-hmm. And this was also confirmed by the former AT&T technician Mark Klein, who exposed the wiretap room on Folsom Street here in San Francisco. And these devices are high-tech sorters. They go through the huge volume of emails and phone calls that are going through these fiber optic switches. And they sort through looking for keywords. And what Bamford reported is that one of these companies maintained what is known as a back door. Mm-hmm. And that they were able to access this information independent of our illegal wiretapping operation. And that this was exposed when, I believe, the government of Australia bought one of these boxes, or maybe a bunch of them, and were using them for their monitoring of telecommunications. Do you have any concerns that if Israel has been busy, pardon me, with these ongoing and what appear to be rather comprehensive efforts to get our secret information for their own use. Do you have any problem going to Israeli vendors with ties to their equivalent of the NSA and buying equipment used to spy on Americans?
I have a lot of concern about that. Yes, I do. And that should never happen. That should never happen. Unfortunately, it happens, I think, more often than we know. I mean, that's just one case that we found out about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm sure there's other cases out there. In fact, I mean, I'm almost positive, let's put it that way, that has occurred before and is still occurring now. And it does cause me a lot of concern.
John, you talked about notifying the State Department and going through that channel when we come across or the FBI comes across these espionage cases, these spies. But then we have cases where we identify the spy in our government to be the person that you actually end up notifying on these espionage cases, and you know what I'm talking about because
yes, I do.
You and I both know about the spy within the State Department that FBI has known about for more than a decade.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know what you're talking about.
And that person who was named recently by Phil Giraldi in an article, Mark Grossman, he happened to be the person who would get the notification. And this is for our listeners, when the FBI would come across, you know, in certain embassies, whether Israel or Turkish embassy, cross espionage cases, he's the one who would be asked to do something about while he himself was the target of espionage investigation.
And let's be just a little more specific for people who are coming across Mark Grossman for the first time. He was our ambassador to Turkey during the Clinton administration, and then he returned to Washington where he had a very high-level State Department post. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So go ahead, John.
Sybil, you're absolutely right. I mean, most of the FBI, when we run investigations on a foreign intelligence officer or any foreign entity that is involved with a foreign government, then what we normally do is we send a letter into the State Department telling them that we're investigating this individual or this entity. And it may not be the individual itself. It could be an organization, a foreign organization.
Right, such as, let's say, AIPAC, or correct.
Exactly, so that the State Department is aware in case something happens and there's an international incident that occurs from that. So, yes, the State Department knows of every investigation involving a foreign national, a foreign intelligence officer, or, you know, somebody working for the State, a diplomat, a foreign business or organization. They know about that ahead of time. So, yes, they are fully aware of what's going on.
And so they will be very, very valuable for recruitment for foreign agents, for foreign countries, because if you have the person in the State Department in that position, then you have access to all the open investigations on your own agents in that country being U.S.
That's correct.
So let's say if I'm giving hypothetical here, if Israel has Mark Grossman in that position, and Mark Grossman is the man who gets all the files and the cases from the FBI on Israeli spies, then the Israel knows who FBI is monitoring and has already, you know, figured out to be the spy.
That's correct.
I know to many people this would, John, this would sound like some kind of a Grisham or what, Clancy novel.
Yeah.
But this is the reality of it. It is so screwed up that FBI, even though they know this person in the State Department is a suspect and is under investigation, they still would notify this person of the their own discovery of the agents, of the foreign agents, let's say Israeli or Turkish agents.
Well, you know, that's why there needs to be oversight, there needs to be accountability.
But they're classified. How are you going to have an oversight? Now they don't want to even give access to the Congress.
Oh,
they're saying the Congress, you know, doesn't have clearance to hear this. I mean, come on, they gagged the Congress on my case. They said we are retroactively classifying.
I know, that's exactly.
So who's putting up oversight, John?
That reminds me of when the FBI, when I got called up to the Hill, up to Congress, the Senate, and to talk about oversight issues. That was the other thing, as part of the retaliation, the Bureau, they did an OPR investigation on me for providing information to members of Congress.
Yeah. They did the same thing with me. That was the basis of their request for polygraph, that they suspected me of disclosing information to Congress.
Yeah.
So let's get real here. All right,
yeah.
So we're talking about the need for oversight and accountability, but then we're saying ain't no one is high enough to have the security clearance to get to see in order to have the oversight. So who's going to have the oversight, John?
Well, that's just it. I mean, that's something that has to be done. There has to be something put in the system.
Revolution.
Well, I don't go that far. But there has to be something. There has to be an entity that has oversight. Congress is not doing it. It's almost as if they have too many other things to do. And with Congress is one thing. Congress won't get onto any issue unless they see that it's going to give them, exposure. It's going to help them out.
They're being recruited by foreign governments, John.
If they don't think that it's going to help them in their careers, they're not going to bring it up. You know what I'm saying? Congress is kind of a waste, as far as I'm concerned. You go up there, you tell them what's going on, they're like, oh, this is terrible. They'll listen to you for that day, and the next day it's almost as if they forgot everything you said, and they forget about who you are.
That's because you didn't throw a fundraiser for them.
I guess. I can't. Or they'll say something like, "Well, man, if I make this public, I'm not going to get all this money from the Israeli lobby." I'm saying that these guys are doing this and that they shouldn't be doing this, and we want this investigated and we want this stopped. Well, are they going to support me? No, they're not. So. They only pick and choose what they want. And
this
what
is
they
not the system our founding father put in place then, John, because, see, we had three branches. Mm-hmm. So if they were supposed to function a particular way, but they didn't have all this. We have what? We spend about $2 billion, $20 billion in keeping classified documents, the mm-hmm. government executive branch classified documents. So when the president can say state secrets privilege to court and make them irrelevant, that's one branch. So right. Let's kick them out. They're irrelevant because the executive branch says it's state secrets privilege is classified. So, boom, you're out. And then they go to the Congress and say, no, it's classified. This is NSA operations that you can't hear about. And they make them irrelevant. Then that leaves one branch.
Right.
So are you suggesting that oversight is going to be someone from the executive branch, meaning they are going to go ahead and have oversight over themselves?
Yeah, no. See, I have no idea, Sibel.
Right,
really
I've given up. There you go.
Because I don't know how they would do it.
Apparently you two haven't heard that the checks and balances that were set up by our founding fathers have shifted, and the rule now is you cash the checks and screw the balances.
Well, that's the way it's been, yes. It seems sad. You're right. Because there's no checks and balances.
Now, John, let me ask you for your reaction to one of the stunning things that Sibel Edmonds blew the whistle on. And this involves Douglas Dickerson, who was a military attaché under Mark Grossman in Ankara, Turkey. That's their capital in the 1990s.
Right.
And his wife, Melek Khan Dickerson, was also a translator working in the same unit with Sibel at the FBI. And she reported to her superiors a very unusual visit that she received from Mrs. Dickerson at her home, where they attempted to recruit her. And so she reported that as required, the mandated reporting that we talked about earlier.
Uh-huh.
And that's what got the retaliation that led to her dismissal from the FBI and ultimately the gag order that was imposed under this fuzzy state secret privilege that is asserted. What can you add to that story, and how do you react to it? Is this commonplace where we have people who are Americans who have been posted in foreign locations and end up coming back compromised and appear to be working as double agents.
I think, I'll just say this, I think that happens a lot. I think that there's more than we know out there. And it seems like, you know, there's supposed to be certain things in place to prevent that. For example, you're supposed to have your five-year reinvestigation every year. You're supposed to have a polygraph every year or every 5 years. If you're read into any special programs, you're supposed to be polygraphed again and go through another type of a background, a little more in-depth background than the already very in-depth background investigation. But the problem is a lot of these people that are in those positions are above the law. They come back, no one is holding them to the same standards, and they get away with it. Perfect example, Hansen. I look at Hansen. I mean, when I first started working in the FBI, I worked with Hansen in the Soviet Analytical Unit. I speak Russian. Hansen used to bring notes in and have me translate them. And I mean, what the hell is this all about? You know, I'm just a young guy, don't know what the hell is going on, but, you know, he's been here for a long time. I guess he knows what he's doing. And Hansen was committing espionage. He was doing all these things. We had a case that was going on at the time, back in 1985, and there was only a handful of people that knew about this investigation that we had. And one morning I came into the office, and everything just went away. It's like, what the hell happened? The IO left the country. The people that were involved were gone. It just disappeared. And Hansen came in that morning, and I'll never forget this. I mean, he goes, I told him, I said, something happened, something's wrong. And told him what happened, and his comment was, oh, man, somebody, we must have a leak. This is Hansen telling me this. We must have a leak. It's probably at the CIA or State Department. So he says, we need to go out and polygraph those guys, and there's only a handful of them that we need to polygraph. FBI management, you know, said the same thing. They said, yeah, it's got to be somebody at the CIA. Nobody wanted to believe it was somebody in the FBI, especially a senior person like Bob Hansen was. So he kept going on and on throughout his, you know, tenure committing espionage, and no one stopped him. And there was a lot of other things that happened along the way before he got arrested that were indicators that, you know, somebody should have called him in and checked, you know, did a polygraph investigation on him, just some simple things, and I think they would have caught him. But no one did. And I think that's like a lot of these guys that like Dickerson, he's above the law. He comes back, says, you know, hey, I don't need that. You trust me.
John, while you're at it, can you tell us, you don't have to name your source, but the IG-related, Air Force IG-related source who knew of Major Douglas Dickerson being under investigation by the IG back then in 1990s while he was in Turkey?
Yes. There was an investigation on him, and it was a joint Air Force FBI investigation, actually. And it basically didn't go anywhere. It seemed like it was just, you know, thrown under the rug. Nothing was ever done with that case. And there was a lot of stuff
kept
there.
His clearance.
Pardon?
He came back to the United States. His wife started working for the FBI. Mm-hmm. And he started working for Richard Perle and Douglas Feith in Pentagon starting in 2001.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's correct. And nothing was ever done. The investigation stopped. No one...
It seems to be something more cynical at work here than incompetence.
The thing is, though, I'm just going to say this. I know when I was in the FBI, and we had cases similar to that. I can't get into any detail on the cases, but I'll tell you this. We were working the cases. The street agent was out there busting his hump, trying to, you know, get the evidence we needed to go to make the arrest. That would come back to headquarters. We'd work it at headquarters. And when we sent it up further, up to management, then it would just die. And we would ask the question. There was a case like that involving a Turkish investigation I had years ago, where we knew the IO was coming into town with a suitcase full of money to pay his source here in the States, the individual who's committing the espionage. We knew exactly when they were going to meet, where they were going to meet, and the money that was going to be exchanged. We knew all that. And I remember that was going to happen on a weekend. And I called the FBI office that was involved, and I told them, I said, okay, we need to send our surveillance teams out there, and this is going to come down on this day, this time, at this place. We knew the time, place, everything. And I said, when it goes down, give me a call at home or page me. Let me know what's going on. Well, I went home that Friday night expecting a call that weekend. I never received a phone call. I came in on Monday, and I asked the section chief. I asked my boss. I said, his name was Bill. I said, Bill, what the hell happened? I was expecting a phone call this weekend. Well, he said nobody was ever sent out there, so nothing was done. They pulled the agents off of that case to work on a more higher priority case. I said, wait a minute. We knew the guy was coming in. We knew the place. We knew the time. All we had to do was send three or four guys out there and just sit there for a half an hour during that time frame, and we would have had them. Hey, why couldn't we do that? And there was no explanation. So something had been done to make sure that nobody was arrested. And I'll never forget that. As long as I live, I'll never
forget that. That's why we have these crusty guys in Congress mm-hmm. who've been there for many, many years.
Somebody did not want that to come down. They didn't want the Turkish IO to be arrested, and they didn't want the American that was committing the espionage, they didn't want that individual to be arrested. So they just ignored it. They just ignored the fact that we had all that information, and they didn't pursue it. They didn't want it done.
John, as we wrap up here, I wanted to touch on two things briefly. One is that I know that part of your duties over the years at the FBI involved compliance with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Are you comfortable with the so-called reforms, the modifications that were rammed through the Congress in the summer of 2008? And do you believe that our government is in compliance with the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution?
I'm not comfortable, and no, I don't think we are in compliance. I'll tell you that right now. There was a lot of problems with the FISAs. I did a lot of FISAs when I was in the FBI. I did hundreds of FISA packages. And there was a certain way that you had to prepare those packages, and you had to get them initialed in different areas every time you went to, go through each step. And each step back then, I felt was fair. I said, we go through the National Security Law Unit, they check off on it. They make sure that no one's rights are getting violated. They make sure that it's complete and it is in tune with what the law states. And then it goes over to the Department of Justice. They review it over there. OIPR reviews it. Their attorneys over there review it. Make sure that it's in compliance with what the laws state. And then it goes to FISA court. And then the judge, there's only a handful of judges that sit on that FISA mm-hmm. court. And back then, anyway, I think they were very fair. I think they wanted to make sure that everything was the way it's supposed to be, and no one's rights were being violated. That has taken a drastic change, I think, over the years. Like I was saying before, with the Patriot Act and some of these other things that came out, I just think that was a big mistake. There's some parts of the Patriot Act that are good. I mean, I have to say that there's probably a couple things in the Patriot Act that might be beneficial. But the majority of it is just wrong, and it just reeks of abuse. I mean, it's just more of an instrument for abuse than anything else.
Well, would you say it's a blueprint for a police state?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And what I can't figure out, and this has been going through my mind for some time now, in 1985 was the year of the spy. I don't know if you remember that or not, but the FBI had made a lot of arrests, caught a lot of people committing espionage, and they deemed it the year of the spy. And that was based on good old-fashioned investigative work. You did the work, you got the evidence together, and you went out and made your arrest. We didn't have all this additional things that they have now with the Patriot Act, because they're not necessary. If people would just do what they're supposed to do on their investigations and follow through with what they're supposed to follow through with, follow the leads, go out and do what they're supposed to do, we wouldn't need all this. The only thing it has done, I think, well, and it's been proven, we know they've violated NSLs, national security letters.
Yep.
We know that.
Sure.
We know that they have set up surveillance on innocent individuals, and yet nothing has ever happened to those people who did that. We know that they've gone in and they've administered certain techniques. I won't go into the techniques, but they've administered certain techniques against innocent Americans, which has caused those individuals a lot of heartache, if not some of them being arrested, falsely arrested. It's just not good. It reminds me of, my mother is Alsatian. She grew up during World War II in Alsace, and she remembers when the Germans came through Alsace, and she remembers the Gestapo and that whole time of terror. And from what I've, you know, heard from her, when I was in Europe, what I've heard from relatives I have there, and what I've read, it's no different. You can't have a society where you're taking away Americans' rights, you're eavesdropping, you're doing surveillance on innocent Americans, you're checking their bank statements, you're checking everything, putting them on a watch list, and you don't even know if they're, you know, with no really reason to do so.
And when you check my bank statements, my banker can't tell me that you did so.
That's right. And you have no recourse. There's no recourse whatsoever. You know, it's just wrong. It's just wrong. I mean, if you check my, you know, let's say you want to take a trip to Turkey, and you get on a plane, you go to Turkey. Well, your name's in a system now that you went to Turkey, and they're going to check your bank records to see how much money did you take with you, and how much money did you come back with, and maybe you're a terrorist, you know. And they can scrutinize and look at you for no reason except for, well, I have this feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't work that way. You shouldn't be, you know, investigating innocent Americans unless you have reason to believe that they're committing an illegal act.
And it got worse at the end of the Bush administration last year. Attorney General Mukasey unilaterally imposed some new standards that essentially allow an FBI agent to make up his own warrant without going to a judge, without any approval from a supervisor. All he has to declare is that he thought he had probable cause, and that is sufficient.
That is correct, and they did the same thing with the FISAs. They were able to go ahead and place the techniques they were going to use, their surveillance techniques, without getting FISA court approval, and then later on going to a FISA court for approval. I mean, it's like putting the cart in front of the horse, you
mm-hmm.
know. And, well, if they make mistakes, no foul, I guess. No one's going to ever find out unless somebody gets hurt. But it's just not right.
John, finally, you were one of the people who blew the whistle on the FBI software scandal in 2001 and 2002. And I know a little more, actually, about the Inslaw scandal of the 1980s. Which was when they tried to develop this case management software called Promise, without an E. And essentially, the FBI drove the Inslaw company into bankruptcy and then just stole the software from them. Nonetheless, it was a failure. And at the time of 9/11, the reports indicated that FBI agents were using computers that were 386s, old chips, very slow, couldn't run large software packages. And so we were told that, well, let's just throw another couple of $100 million at it. And that produced the Trilogy phase of this. Tell us briefly about Trilogy, and then give us an indication of what you think the status of the FBI's computers and computer networks are today.
I could tell you, Trilogy, when that started out, and I'm not a computer guy. I mean, I'm not, I'm technically sterile, that's what I tell everybody, because I don't know a lot about computers. But I do know, you know, how to talk to people and how to get information. And I used to know a lot of the guys that worked on that program, on the Trilogy program. Those were the guys that were developing the software and putting the hardware in place and so on and so forth. And I would go down and talk to these guys and say, how's that coming? And they would kind of laugh and they say, you know, this is never going to work. They're going to wind up having to scrap this whole thing. And they were telling me this at the onset, you know. So the Bureau kept going up saying that there's a delay, we need more money, and the Congress was giving them more money, just throwing the money into this thing, and it was going nowhere. And when I was asked up on the Hill, when the Senate asked me about it, I said, well, my understanding is everybody's calling it tragedy because it's a tragedy that we were spending all this money on a system that's never going to work. I know Leahy and Spector and Grassley, they were kind of saying, well, this ain't good. Well, we're going to send something into, ask the director to give us an update. And the director would go up on the Hill, and he'd testify that everything's going great, you know, no problems. Oh, okay, how much more money do you need? We'll give it to you. Well, in 2003, I believe it was, I was sitting at my desk at FBI headquarters, and Senator Grassley's investigator calls me up and tells me, he goes, John, he goes, you know, Robert Mueller, Director Mueller, is up here testifying, and he claims that Trilogy is up and running. And I told him, I said, well, if it's up and running, I'd like to know where the hell it's running to, because we don't have it in the counterintelligence division, it's not in the counterterrorism division, and hell, it's not in any field office. I'd like to know where the hell it's at. And he goes, well, he's going to let Grassley know that. And I said, well, fine, you know, no problem. Nothing was ever done. They kept getting more money and more money. The director kept going up on the Hill, reassuring him that, you know, this is going to run. Well, I think it was in 2005 is when the director finally came out and said, Trilogy is not going to work. And it's a complete failure. We're going to have to scrap the whole thing and start from scratch. And he said that we started this thing called Sentinel. Now this thing's called Sentinel that they have now. And from my discussions with people I know in the FBI, they're telling me that that's probably never going to run either. It's not going to work. They're still having a lot of problems.
Wow.
Now, they wasted, I don't know how many hundreds of million dollars on Trilogy. They've already spent, they're already over budget on the Sentinel program, and they're behind schedule. Now, if you recall, that was one of the big issues after the 9/11 attacks. You know, the Bureau says, well, we have a problem with our automation system. We can't connect the dots. They were blaming it on the automation problem for not connecting the dots. And here it is, what, you know, 8 years later, and they still don't have a viable system up and running. I think that's pretty pretty bad.
That really is. I mean, I imagine agents use their home computers, but those are not necessarily secure.
No, you can't. That's the thing, though, too. The FBI uses, well, I know they're still using ACS. That's what they used when I was in, Automated Case Management System.
Mm-hmm.
They're still having to use that now. They haven't changed the way they're doing business since the 9/11 attacks as far as the software goes, as far as the computer system, automation system goes. Those systems you cannot use at your house. I mean, they're secure systems. The Bureau is very good about making sure that their systems are only connected to FBI offices. I mean, they don't go outside the FBI, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Their connections don't. So, yeah, you can't use them at home. I mean, you have to use them in the office.
Well, John, I want to thank you for joining us today. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I want to recommend your new book that will be due out shortly here. It's called While America Sleeps, an FBI Whistleblower's Story. John M. Cole is who we've been talking with. And the book will be available online at Amazon and at the Barnes & Noble bookstore chain. And you might look at your local independent bookstore if you like to support them, too. John Cole, thank you for joining us on The Boiling Frogs.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews. Until then.